In a world where mental health problems are used as common tropes in various forms of storytelling, therapist Ryan Engelstad and executive producer Mike Graham try to determine what lines up with real life and what is just exaggerated fantasy. Listen as we delve into the fantastical tales told about mental health in books, movies, and television. This is Pop Psych 101.
Welcome back to Pop Psych 101. I am licensed therapist Ryan Engelstad. Here, subbing in for Mike Graham, is Dean from Podscure. Dean, thank you so much for joining us here on Pop Psych 101.
Oh, it's completely my pleasure. I mean, I've you know, followed you guys for a while now. With Podscure, and we interviewed you last year. It's been a while. But we love what you do, and we definitely want Mike to get back to his fighting weight. It's so important what you guys are doing that, I really want to help in any way I possibly can. And so, I really thank you for having me here so that I can help out with any way, anything you need me to do.
Well, we definitely appreciate that. And yes, definitely big shout out to Mike and his wife, Bree, who are going through a lot right now. We're thinking about you guys. I hope you're taking care of yourselves and each other. And we can't wait to have you back if and when you're ready. But in the meantime, we want to keep having conversations about mental health. So in a little bit, we're going to start talking about Fleabag, which is an incredible show. And we're going to talk about some of the interesting mental health pieces of Fleabag. But before we do that, Dean, Mike and I often kind of talk about mental health things that I find or things that in the news. Yeah. So I had bookmarked myself this article recently. I wanted to get your thoughts on it because I thought it was interesting.
Sure.
I am obviously a big proponent of strategies that help people improve their behavior, change their behavior for positive ways. Mm-hmm. So there was an article recently on Lifehacker that essentially, you would think if you're trying to motivate yourself to change a behavior that, think of rewards, think of things you would want to do. I'll give myself a piece of a food I really like. I'll let myself eat something that I like, or I'll give myself, I'll let myself listen to my favorite podcast, Pop Psych 101, when I'm at the gym, because I'm sure people are doing that.
Exactly.
Stuff like that. And it turns out that those sort of pseudo rewards are not super effective. I imagine that might not surprise you.
Well, it does and it doesn't. I mean, I've done that as well. I quit smoking February of last year. And, it was kind of like those things where you say, okay, if I can quit, I'll have enough money to do, I don't even remember what the hell it was now.
Sure. But
it was that kind of thing that, it was kind of, it's the self-coaching, I guess, in a way. So yeah. to get you where you need to go. I mean, it's, whether it's exercise, if get up this next hill, what have you, I think it's just a way to pump yourself up, like, working out, listening to some really, some AC/DC or whatever, just, those types of things to get your energy going. So you would think that that would help, but it's not surprising to hear that though.
Right. So the other side of this though, is what they found is that crappy rewards, like giving yourself a sticker on a piece of paper or a check mark on a calendar, are actually very effective.
Really?
Which I find fascinating because, what's rewarding about a sticker on a piece of paper or a check mark or on a calendar? And what they found is it actually creates what we in the therapist world call cognitive dissonance. It's like, well, if I'm working out for this crappy sticker, like kind of what's the point? But it's like, oh no, I actually have to justify this stupid reward. So I'm just going to keep doing it because otherwise it feels like, well, what's the point of this little thing? But then we have to sort of justify the little thing being important. So there's a famous strategy called don't break the chain. This was I don't know if it was originated by Jerry Seinfeld, but he's like a proponent of it if you look it up. And what he did every day is that he wanted to write his jokes. So to form that habit, he took out a big desk calendar, and every day he wrote his jokes, he gave himself a check mark on the calendar. And the goal would be to not break the chain of check marks, to make sure you get a check mark every single day. And this is that same idea, that that really simple, small reward is actually kind of weirdly motivating. So I don't know. Do you buy that?
Well, it's not surprising because I think it kind of goes back to that thing when you're kids and, you get the gold star for the day. And I think, there's some good correlations that you have in your head to those times when you did a good thing and you got a sticker. So maybe that's what it harkens back to.
Yeah, sort of taps into something from childhood. Yeah. I bet I would believe that as well. So yeah, funny things to play with. If you're trying to change your behavior, if you're trying to practice better self-care, experiment with giving yourself a quote unquote crappy reward and see if that helps. And with that, let's get into Fleabag, Dean. This is a fascinating show.
It's like, I don't even know how to quantify it. It's so different. It's friggin' hilarious. Number one. Number two, it's really freaking deep. So, there's so much. I mean,
deep and dark
and very, very British all the time. So
let's set it up for people if people haven't seen it before. So, Fleabag, I think, started in 2016 on the BBC. It has had two seasons now, and now all the seasons are available Amazon Prime. I know that's how I watched it. If you had to describe it just based on the characters, how would you describe this show?
A humorous take on working through grief and family dysfunction.
Yeah, a lot of family dysfunction. Yes, I think that'll be a good opportunity for us to talk about this. I mean, we here at PopSyche have talked about grief before, but it was, I think, through the context of Spider-Man. So this is a very different presentation. So we have the main character who, as far as I can tell, only goes by Fleabag. Her name is never actually mentioned in the show that I caught.
And I was looking up the trivia about it, she came up with the idea to do it as a, like, you have 10 minutes to come up with something. And she, for, I think it was for Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah.
Because she is a comedian in her own right. Created this character.
Her name is Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, yes.
And she was one of the, because, they recently, I recently listened to the Doctor Who episode because I'm a big Whovian. She was one of the ones in the final cut to be the new Doctor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, you can totally see it, yeah.
As was godmother in this, Olivia Colman, who is brilliant. Wow.
She is. So we have this main character who goes by Fleabag, sort of informally. And we know from the sort of setup of the show that she has lost her best friend and business partner. And in the sort of setup of the show, we have this sort of weird explanation of how she died and why she sort of killed herself is sort of the way that it's introduced.
It was more like, I don't know what's the term when you pretend like you're going to go through with it. It's not suicide. It's more than suicidal.
Gesture. It's a gesture. Yeah.
So she makes a gesture that actually ends up working out.
Yes.
There's some really heavy stuff around that Fleabag is really dealing with.
Yeah, so we see her, navigating some of these aspects of grief and loss, and in the meantime, navigating her own dysfunctional family. So it's a lot of different aspects of mental health in this show that we wanted to cover. We're not going to be able to cover both seasons and all the ins and outs of all the different character interactions with Fleabag, but I think there are a couple of things from the two seasons that we do want to talk about. So Dean, as you watched Fleabag and probably rewatched it,
right?
What's one of the first things that maybe jumped out to you?
Even though she was really charming and funny, that she owned it. I mean, her brokenness. And that, in fact, and that what I was telling you about before is that, I have a clip of here that where she wants to really confront her dad about it. And you can know there's something that's been building up. And this is just in episode one.
That's
where,
right.
Where she's drunk and has had, I don't know how many times she's had sex that day, because that's another way she's coping with her grief.
Yeah.
But then she goes and she has a fuck it moment, gets in the cab and goes to her dad's and has this interaction with him.
You know, it's nearly 2 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Oh, fuck it. I have a horrible feeling that I'm a greedy, perverted, selfish, apathetic, cynical, depraved, morally bankrupt woman who can't even call herself a feminist.
Well, you get all that from your mother.
And I don't know if Dad is just trying to... I don't know what his intention with that is. I mean, her reaction to that is good one, but it's, I mean, that's a very British type of thing to hold all that in. I mean,
yeah,
the stiff upper lip. That's all.
Yeah. So I actually think that's a really good place for us to start with this show, is that the way that, Fleabag and Phoebe Waller-Bridge, sort of portrays herself with the breaking of the fourth wall, the talking to the audience, talking to the camera. I thought it was just an awesome way to give an audience sort of clues into what her emotional experience was without over-exaggerating, I think, from a character perspective. Like, they told us without having to show us. Is that... And I think what happens sometimes in how people portray mental health on screen is that a lot of times depression, anxiety, grief, and things like that are very subtle. Everything's kind of happening internally, right? So to have a character who talks to the camera, talks to the audience, and can kind of give little asides to, like, this is what's going on inside of my head, this is what I'm thinking about, or the little sort of blinks, the flashes of Boo, of her deceased best friend, that I just think it's a really genius way of portraying the sort of fragile and broken in some ways nature of Fleabag's mental health.
Yeah. She's got very poignant views through each time. I mean, even just through a look, breaking the fourth wall. She doesn't even have to say anything. There'll just be a look.
Yeah.
And you know exactly what she's trying to relate. And it seems like, especially in this first season, she's just trying to find a hand to hold on to. I mean, if you look at her relationship with her sister, which is probably her closest relationship, it's so frigid. I mean, even after they have their feminist lecture, which Dad pays for all these weird things, like to send them feminist lectures, breast exams, a silent retreat, I mean, all these things that he pays to send them to, which are very odd for a dad to send somebody to, in my opinion, being a dad. Yeah. I can't see myself doing that. But I mean, if I was asked, sure. But just those things that that she goes through, and dealing with her sister, the sister trying to even make a connection because she's having a hard time.
Where
she goes to hug her, and she ends up slapping her.
Yeah, violent reaction. Yeah,
right. And so it's just like, it's like, why would you do that?
It's a great question. I think we see multiple different character perspectives on how they're coping with grief, right? Because I don't even think we mentioned that Fleabag and Claire's mom also passed away when they were young, though. Right? I couldn't get a sense of exactly how old they were.
They were adults when mom passed away, because they kind of reflect back to the funeral.
I must have forgotten.
There's the reflection back to the funeral. So this has just probably been 2 or 3 years, my guess, somewhere.
So
in
the fact that they've lost their mom recently, and then Fleabag obviously loses her friend tragically. You know, a lot of times in grief and loss, if it's a quote unquote negative reaction, sometimes that's born out of these previous experiences that we've had, good, bad, or indifferent. And there's also one scene in particular where is sort of really connecting to this like, what's the right way to grieve? Is Fleabag and Claire are in a graveyard, there's, and they see a guy at a grave just like wailing, like losing it, and Claire kind of is like almost relates to him, like, oh, that must be so difficult. And Fleabag is immediately like, that's not real. Like, he's just kind of making it up, or he's just going to grave to grave.
He's also at a different. He's searching for some kind of validation for himself.
Sure.
But I think what she's right, because he's at a different grave site every day.
Right. So she is right.
You jog here every day.
Yeah. So she is right in identifying that, but it's this reaction of that sort of intense emotional reaction isn't real or isn't appropriate. And I think that what we see from these characters is that there's no one right way to grieve, is that everyone is just sort of trying to figure it out as they go.
Oh yeah, like we all are. So yeah. if there was a book that said this is how you get through it, I mean you'd be out of a job. So
well there are books like that, but that doesn't mean that they totally solve the problem, right? Right.
If they make a Shulton's Guide for the Human.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's crazy how the mind works, and to lack of a better term, that, you know, we all have our own way. We got to choose our path and what works for us. And, you know, my path is different than yours, and that's okay.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what we see with Fleabag is that she sort of recognizes over the course of the two seasons that the way that she's coping or attempting to cope is, like, at best unhealthy, at worst, like, dangerous.
And she relishes that a little bit. The danger.
You sort of touched on it at the beginning, where she just kind of wants to laugh and make light of just about everything.
Right.
And I've had patients like this, and they know, it's like, yeah, I just make a joke about everything, even, you know, if it's the saddest thing that's ever happened to me, I'm going to make a joke about it. and it's both hard and refreshing. It's like this weird balance of, you know, are you actually handling this okay, or is this just the sort of defense mechanism?
Yeah, I
don't know if that's something that you can relate to. I mean, yeah.
Oh, I could very much relate to it. I mean, I even with sessions with my therapist, shout out to Amy Alpine, she's awesome. She will go with it, but she definitely keeps me on track. She's got some good humor for me, but she'll, you know, when she sees me trying to deflect, which, you know, what I liken it to is, I heard something that, you know, you spend 40 years getting into a forest, you're not getting out in two.
Exactly right.
So the only thing I feel I can do sometime, you just got to laugh at it. Otherwise you cry. So, I mean, and I do plenty of crying as it is. I feel that big time. I mean, you know, just, I gotta laugh it off.
Yeah.
Otherwise I will just be so in myself.
Well, yeah. And it's funny that you say that, because there was a really powerful scene when Fleabag and Claire is Claire, right? I'm not screwing up her sister's name.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Yep.
When Claire are at the sort of silence mindfulness retreat, where, Fleabag is sort of like periodically interested in what's happening at a Better Men retreat that's happening on the same grounds. So that was also really, really funny. There's one scene where she and a man who she knows from a previous episode have this connection, this really honest connection about why they're trying to make improvements, or why they're trying to change themselves. And Fleabag actually says, I just want to cry all the time. And at that point in the sort of first season, it feels like the most honest thing that she's said up to this point, of like how real her grief actually is, that she wants to cry all the time, and that everything she does is sort of an attempt to hide or shield herself from that emotional experience.
Totally. I mean, I think that's what... why she has that interaction with her dad. This is the first time she's able to find someone who she can have the interaction with. I mean, she's tried it with her dad, she's tried it with her sister, and she's not getting that. And Boo is gone, who's been that outlet. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was her anchor. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. And so they were, that was a beautiful relationship between mm-hmm. she and Boo. And
yeah.
I'm interested to see how when season three comes about, how she ends up addressing that, coming to grips with what has happened. I don't know if we want to go into the spoiler of that, but.
Well, yeah, I think it's inevitable that we're going to. So we'll just say spoiler alert at this point,
right?
Because we're going to get into some of the sort of big aha moments from this series. So we don't necessarily have to jump right into that because, you know, one of the other things that I wanted to talk about is this sort of silence retreat in general. So, you know, we mm-hmm. have a character in Fleabag and her sister, obviously, to the same extent, that are trying to cope, trying to better themselves, trying to survive. And one of the things that is, I believe, purchased for them by their father is this silence retreat, this mindfulness retreat. So these are things that happen in real life. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that for some people, it's probably weird and just seems like a really hippie thing to do, to go to a retreat like this. So people might be wondering, like, how real is this sort of an experience? Is this something that people actually benefit from? I don't know what your reaction, how much exposure you have to things like this.
Oh, no, I've never had anything like that. I mean, what I found odd about it personally was that it was allowing the men to be violent to women icons and keeping women silent. So it was like, that's the opposite of what I felt it should have been. Empower the women. Shut up, guys.
right. Or learn how to control yourselves. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it was a really interesting sort of dichotomy, like these two opposites that are happening at the same time. But yeah, for me, you know, because this whole idea of mindfulness is very much in vogue in the sort of mental health world, where it's just like, oh, just, you know, be quiet. And I think even at one point in the retreat, one of the leaders says something like, you know, getting into your mind prison or something like that, like imprisoning your thoughts. And I had such a strong reaction to that, because that is not my definition of mindfulness at all. And I think it's actually a pretty harmful one. I think that the idea of being trapped in with your thoughts doesn't really feel helpful to me. And, you know, silence retreats have their own sort of mixed bag of benefit. But, you know, well, I guess maybe I could ask you this, Dean, like, what is your exposure or familiarity with mindfulness?
Well, it's just really sitting down and, for me anyway,
yeah,
you know, contemplating myself and how I deal with my surroundings, my people and my work, et cetera, those types of things. And, you know, studying myself and what's in my mind and how I work with my reactions to things. Can I do something better? How should I do that thing? So that's really what it is. It's a study of oneself, and to come up with a new, do I need a new way, or is what I'm doing good?
That's so increasing the sort of self-awareness. Yeah, no, that is well said. I think for me, the distinction that I want to make from the show is that, you know, we're not looking to imprison anyone with their thoughts. We're actually looking to sort of increase the, and this sounds sort of hoity-toity, but like the flow of those thoughts. We don't want people to get stuck in any thought, because for someone like Fleabag, who's obviously very much stuck in the memories and pain of the loss of her friend, her thoughts are not flowing. She gets stuck and then, does something impulsive to kind of distract herself. So with a mindfulness practice, she kind of gets in touch with some of those emotions, recognizes what she's experiencing, what she's feeling, and lets those feelings sort of resolve or pass in a natural way, instead of just sort of trying to ignore or pretend it's not happening and then distract herself with something impulsive or, in several cases, unhealthy. So instead of picturing it like a prison, more like a stream of consciousness where the thoughts are going to flow freely and you don't have to hold on or stop any one of them, because new thoughts and new pieces of awareness will always come by.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's kind of that, there's a right time for maybe either of those. And again, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about. Everybody has their own path.
Yes.
What works and what doesn't work. It's that kind of that, the Tao of you.
yeah, for sure.
So it's not, you know, I'm not going to smash it. If it works for you, awesome.
Right. But, and we'd be gentle in smashing it, but I think there's a consensus that what Fleabag is doing to work it or make it work for her is pretty unsuccessful. At least
she has some definitely unhealthy coping. The amount of just random sex, if whether she's male, female, or non-binary, what have you, I it just feels like there's no rhyme or reason to it. And I don't want to prejudge anybody just because I'm not judging her because of that, slut shaming.
Okay.
I'm definitely not doing that. So
of course
I definitely want to say that she's dealing with her emotions via just having sex instead of having sex just for pleasure. That's
right. So
know,
there's nothing wrong with having, it's a cope. We're not judging multiple partners. We're not judging all these sorts of things, like,
right,
to each their own. But I think we're trying to recognize, exactly, that this behavior that Fleabag is involved in, which feels like specifically to distract her or help her feel something other than what she's feeling, which might be wanting to cry all the time, that is not an effective coping skill for what she's dealing with. And she, to a certain degree, recognizes that. But despite that recognition, sort of continues indulging more or less in these behaviors. And if we were to look at sort of where she is in the sort of, stages of grieving, it's so interesting. So we have, the denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. She's definitely not accepted. She's not done with the stages, right? At times, she's pretty clearly depressed, whether it's just saying things like she just wants to cry all the time, to the extent that she's angry. And this is the sort of spoiler alert part, is anger at herself, right? She sort of, in ways, like, hates herself because of the things that she does or has done.
Right. Or, even though she has some culpability.
Right.
So, it's not just sex. Just in like episode one, she's like, she just screws up from time and time again, hooking up with a guy on the bus and then her sister's stolen top. So she steals things
time. Yeah. Yep.
So, mm-hmm. She's very manipulative, especially with Harry, her boyfriend.
Yes. Her ex-boyfriend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things that she does, whether it's, and I love how the sculpture kind of plays throughout the entire series.
It reappears and it reappears. Yeah.
Right. And then just that there's so much, she's with Harry and she's bored, and while she's having sex with him, masturbates,
pushes him away.
Right.
Yeah.
Just so, let's get this over with. I would just want to get out. And then she just passes out. She just has some very unusual and definitely what seems to me unhealthy coping mechanisms for what she's done, especially in season one.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, I was going to say, and if we were to sort of take a look at that and psychoanalyze or overanalyze, and to the extent that this sort of pattern happens for a lot of different people, not necessarily the sex part, but the sort of trying to find a sense of normalcy or a sense of control after a loss, like the one that Fleabag has experienced, is pretty common. Because if you think about from a broad perspective, when a family member or significant other or even close friend, in the case of Fleabag, business partner, passes away, you go from everything being sort of normal, to the extent that it's normal, to everything being completely different. Not necessarily good or bad, but just, now my life has, completely flipped. My business partner's not here. My friend, my confidant, I mean, they often portray the relationship between Fleabag and Boo as like a very loving one, almost as if they were partners.
Right. Exactly. That's kind of how I felt, initially watching that. Is that what's going on? But no, they have a very intimate friend relationship.
Yes. So in this sort of aftermath, we see Fleabag essentially trying to, establish a new normal, whether that's find a relationship that she's happy in, rebuild family connections that can sort of cover up what she's lost in losing Boo. I think the sense that I see in her relationship with her sister is very much, she's trying to grab onto something despite sort of seeing her sister as someone who's sort of uptight and difficult to connect with. She wants to connect with her.
She does. And she loves her sister.
Yeah.
She has this adoration for her, and I think she kind of envies, her, wishes she had some of that. I mean, she's got her sister has Martin, who's really not a nice guy, and Brett Gelman is a great actor and is always good at playing the asshole.
Yeah, yeah.
and he's so far the only American in the series.
Right.
Yeah, there's weird, creepy thing. I mean, his son and that whole thing. Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's just so much. I'm like, how do you cram this much dysfunction in this one family? It's just nuts. I mean, and then not only is she getting over or trying to grieve about Boo, but she's still not gotten over her mother.
Oh no. Yeah. That's very clear.
So it's like, it's double whammy.
Mm-hmm.
So and I think that's kind of why she's definitely trying to reconnect with Claire. And she needs a unit.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. And we sort of think about it in this sense, something to ground herself in, something to anchor herself in, because Boo was such a strong anchor for her, mm-hmm. business-wise, friendship-wise, that without that, she's just sort of floating around, bouncing from person to person, trying to find something that gives her some sense of comfort, some sense of reassurance, some sense of love. I mean, we know she doesn't feel great about herself for various reasons. And then I think not having the sort of universal acceptance that Boo gave her, that even when she was sort of weirdly uncomfortable in giving her the guinea pig, like that's turned into this huge powerful connection between them.
Yes.
That she got that sort of unconditional love and acceptance from Boo that she doesn't really feel anywhere else.
Right. Yeah, it's that whole the guinea pig, and she still holds it, like, mm-hmm. this is the Boo's soul is in this,
yes.
and even yes. At the where the guy comes and gives her, it's a hamster, but he says it's a guinea pig, but it's kind of that, there's some additional validation there for her, especially going from 1 to 2, where she's really saying, okay, this, I'm going to start doing something healthy. And it's like, you were rooting for her. And then came the priest.
And we'll sort of bookend that, and we're going to come back to some of the guilt and things. Yeah, because so the end of season one, it's revealed that Fleabag, sort of the impetus for Boo, following through with the suicidal gesture, which ends up, unfortunately, she does die from what she does, is that Boo actually slept with the guy that she was seeing.
Right.
I'm sorry. Fleabag slept with the guy that Boo was seeing.
Correct.
And when that's revealed,
it's very like, whoa. Even all the stuff that Fleabag has done, mm-hmm. you never would think, because of her relationship with Boo, that she would have ever do something like this.
Yeah.
So it was definitely very surprising to me. So
it's both surprising and it also sort of really clears up a lot of the things. Things start to make a little bit more sense. It's like, okay, so actually this is a lot of guilt, and this is a lot of sort of ownership that Fleabag carries over the loss of her friend, that she feels in some ways responsible for what played out. And we don't necessarily see her saying that. She doesn't say that to the counselor she sees in season two. Right. but we know it. So we see and we know this stuff is under the surface for her. And that's such just, I mean, dealing with grief and loss is hard enough if you're also carrying a sense of responsibility for that person's essentially right. death. That's a whole different layer of things to overcome.
Yeah, but I mean, and she could have, and I think she knew that she couldn't do anything like, I mean, because she could have with Martin. Martin, right. You know, Martin had come on to her and she had a bit of a moment, a friend moment with Martin.
Yeah.
Shopping for Sis's birthday.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was, you know, you thought, oh, maybe things will get good, but no, they mm-hmm. didn't. And then Martin's a creep. And
yeah.
And, you know, she didn't let it happen and she could have easily mm-hmm. let it happen.
Yeah.
But, I think that was kind of the turning point for her.
Mm-hmm. So then we're into season two and we finally see a interaction between Fleabag and a counselor. She got a voucher for one session
from her father. Right?
That
yes.
was yes, from her father.
Because of the outburst at the party. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. right, which we glossed over. So yeah, Fleabag hauls off and gives gives her sister's Martin. Husband. Yeah, Martin, yeah. a good beating, more or less.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So and that sort of then leads us into season two, in which there's some legal things happening and obviously relationship things happening. But I wanted to talk about the therapy session because I thought it was so fascinating and very British is sort of
oh,
what
yeah.
my assumption is.
And Fiona Shaw, who plays the counselor, Aunt Petunia from Harry Potter, if yep. you may mm-hmm. recognize, she was brilliant.
So why have you come to the session?
It was a birthday present for my father.
Is that a joke?
No.
It would be good not to make jokes in here, just in case anything gets lost in humorous translation.
Oh, I don't know if I can do that.
Is that a joke?
No.
Just try not to make it very obvious.
Sure.
So why do you think your father suggested you come for counselling?
I think because my mother died and he can't talk about it. And my sister and I didn't speak for a year because she thinks I tried to sleep with her husband. And because I spent most of my adult life using sex to deflect from the screaming void inside my empty heart. I'm good at this. Although I don't really do that anymore.
You close with your family?
We get on with it.
Do you talk?
God, no.
Any friends?
Sorry?
Any friends?
No, I don't really have time for... Well, I have a guinea pig, but she blows hot and cold. Not a joke.
Tell me about the sex.
All of it?
You said you don't do that now.
Oh, no, I just play tennis now. Tough crowd. Sorry. I just... Sex didn't bring anything... good, so I'm trying not to, but I've...
And what have you found in your abstinence?
Well, I'm very horny, and your little scarf isn't helping.
So the impulse is still there?
Oh, yeah, the impulse is very much still there. It's just never the right person.
Hmm. So there is a particular person you're not having sex with?
No. Well, nothing's happened. I just... He's not available.
In a relationship?
Yes, a bad one.
How so?
It's a sort of relationship where one partner tells the other how to dress.
Are you in love with him?
No.
Why do you find that funny?
Well, I don't know.
Just not romantic?
No.
Just a girl with no friends and an empty heart. By your own description.
I have friends.
Oh, so you do have someone to talk to.
Yeah.
Do you see them a lot?
Oh, they're always there. They're always there.
Why do you find that funny?
Listen, I don't need to be analysed. I have a nice life. I just wanted to exchange the voucher for the money.
It's a bit late for that now.
I've only been here 5 minutes. I want the money. I want to fuck a priest.
Catholic?
Yes.
A good one?
Yes.
Looks good in the...
Yes.
I understand. Do you really want to fuck the priest, or do you want to fuck God?
Can you fuck God?
Oh, yes.
Just please tell me how to not fuck a priest before I get arrested.
Well, I don't think fucking a priest will make you feel as powerful as you think it will.
Can you just tell me what to do?
You know. You already know what you're going to do. Everybody does.
What?
You've already decided what you're going to do.
So what's the point in you?
You know what you're going to do.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do.
I don't.
You do.
I don't.
You do.
I don't. Good luck.
Thank you.
Shut up.
It cuts to her. She knew.
Man, what a brutal therapist. Not bad, just brutal, no. Like straight. She calls her to her face. A girl with no friends and an empty heart. I don't think I could ever get away with saying that to a patient. Probably because I'm not old and British. I think most of my patients would just walk out. But it's fascinating because I think that this is sort of a portrayal of a therapist that a lot of people, if you ask them to picture a therapist, that they might picture this kind of person, a older lady, fancy scarf, a little severe, mm-hmm. not in a bad way, but just like I'm here, a little confrontational. And look, there are definitely therapists like this, but I don't know. I don't know, and Mike and I have talked about this on the show before, like, I don't know how receptive to this style people are always going to be. So when you saw this therapist, well, how did you react?
I thought it was, I liked her in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I was about to say, she calls her on her bullshit.
Yep.
You know, so
that much
and
is
she
true.
Says by your, because like what you said, but then she follows up with by your own description.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So yes. it's like I'm not calling you this.
Right.
This is what you've relayed to me.
Yeah. That's
so,
right.
I think and my therapist is like that too, which is I really appreciate. I need somebody to hold my feet to the fire a little bit sometimes. So,
sure.
But she's all you know. But had you know, we're again, we only saw 5 minutes, so we don't know what was going to continue after that.
That's
so
true. That's true.
Yeah, I think I think for you know, especially when she said, but what's the point of you? You know what you're going to do.
Well, which is a really fair question, I thought, because for a therapist to say you already know what you're going to do, well, shouldn't that's the logical response from the patient of like, well, then why do I need to see you? What's the point of you?
True.
Because if everyone already knows what they're going to do, are they just coming to a therapist for reassurance, for comfort, or for confrontation? Because she pretty much asks the therapist, can you just tell me what to do not to get arrested?
Right.
Right. So I don't get arrested.
How do you get arrested for having sex with a priest?
Yeah. Right. And I certainly have interacted with patients where they do just want to be told what to do. And anytime as a therapist, I'm in that position, it's, I don't necessarily, you already know what to do or you already know what you're going to do, but it is this sort of acknowledgement of, look, even if I told you what to do, the benefit that you experience for that is limited at best because you and I are not going to work together forever.
Right.
And if you're only going to do something because I tell you to do it, that's not going to magically turn into intrinsic motivation. That's
right.
Going to turn into you doing something because your therapist told you to. And once your therapist stops telling you to do things, you're going to go back to your old patterns of behavior.
Yeah, I think like the thing that I really like about my therapist is that it's a collaborative effort.
Yeah.
You know, right. There's, you know, she may know what I'm going to do or what I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
She walks me through coming up with following the path for myself.
Nice.
Which is what I need. I need to find the path. And she's like, you know, in Dungeons and Dragons, you have the dungeon master. He knows where everything is and he can lead you down one path
or
another.
Less, yeah. Yeah.
So it's very much the same way, you know, it's just with your life.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's tough because even if as a therapist, you want to sort of protect people from themselves, you also have to recognize that if you do things for them or if you force them to do things differently, it's not necessarily going to let them sort of make that change authentically and long lastingly, for example. I saw this all the time when I worked in addiction that, you know, we could punish people into not doing drugs, but once that threat of punishment's no longer there, mm-hmm. are they really going to stick to doing what they are supposed to do, quote unquote?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You really have to make the decision. I mean, cause yeah, I mean, you can join a 12-step program by, you know, if you got a DUI and the judge has told you to go do it. Is that really going to be the best option for you? I mean, it might be if you've also decided, oh crap, I'm at the end. I've hit rock bottom. I need to do this, as opposed to someone saying, you've got to do this. Yeah, whatever. Okay, I'll go. You know, you've got to take ownership.
That's right. Yeah. And it's just a really interesting interaction, I think. And even to connect it to the mindfulness retreat, you know, people can force you to do things differently or can like walk the path for you. They can make you be silent. They can make you do different coping skills. They can tell you what to do or what not to do. But if there's not an inclination on your own part because you know the consequences or because you want to change, you know, because of your own self-awareness, not necessarily because of things that have happened externally, that's the only way things are going to change in a long-lasting way. You know, I look at things like crash dieting and things like that where, yeah, you might get the results you want for a short period of time, right. But is that a lifestyle that you're going to be able to maintain long-term? No.
No.
Of course not. No. And it's the same thing in some cases with things like mindfulness retreats, where you might have a great weekend of silence and mindfulness, but if you go back and do your impulsive behaviors or whatever, then it's the mindfulness stays there. Mindfulness stays at the retreat.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like work. It's like any other learning mechanism where, you know, you're going to learn these tools. If you choose to, if you find them useful, that's awesome. If they work for you, great. If they don't, put them away or, you know, maybe teach somebody else. Here's something I learned that might work for you. Didn't work for me, but it could work for you because it didn't work for me because of XYZ, but you've got ABC, you know,
and
it might help you. So, I mean, I think it's good to learn all the tools if they're useful tools, but you know, and everybody's got their own set of useful tools.
Yeah. And to the extent that Fleabag is coming into therapy for the first time, you know, and for anybody going into therapy the first time, like these are normal questions. I think people have the sort of normal reaction of, oh, you know, just tell me what to do so I can not have to deal with this problem anymore. So I don't have to be depressed anymore. Like just help me get out of this. You know, when I've worked with parents, it's like, they don't say this, but the implication is like, can you just fix my kid? Can you just do whatever you magic thing you want to do and make it so I don't have to deal with this problem anymore? And very frequently, the solution is actually the parents need therapy as much as the kids do. And that's how we can kind of circle back to Fleabag, right? Because this is a dysfunctional family that has led to these dysfunctional behaviors. Whether it's dad's, you know, attempt to connect with his children by sending them to feminist lectures or buying things for them, or the daughter's sort of weird attempts to connect with each other, but, you know, under the surface, a genuine affection for each other.
Right.
You know, there's real opportunities here for growth if they're willing to do the work.
Right. Yeah. I think I don't know if dad does what he does in an effort to, he thinks he's, honestly, I think Godmother has put him all up to these things.
Sure.
And in a way to keep distance, because she obviously does not like the girls. She likes Claire more than Fleabag, of course, but, yeah, I think a lot of this comes from her and keeps them separated from dad. She wants to occupy dad. Yeah, that's a whole other.
I mean, we could do a whole other episode on the family therapy that would be necessary here.
Olivia Colman is so great in that role.
Yeah.
It's one of those you love to hate her.
Well, from the moment you meet her, and you meet her through Fleabag's eyes, obviously, where it's like, you can't totally tell if this woman is for real, is like, or is she just being like intentionally antagonistic towards Fleabag, and or is it just like, no, this is just her, this is the kind of person that she is. And it's like, wow, well, you kind of get why Fleabag is as down on her as she is.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of backhanded compliments, and you know, it was like, it seemed obvious. You look so, I mean, like the whole thing at the funeral where she looked too pretty, mm-hmm. and you know, it's just everything just there. She could do nothing right, no matter what she tried. But yeah, there was definitely some hard, I mean, the part, I love the part where she finally slapped her and, mm-hmm. but Dad saw it and didn't do anything. And I just want to throttle him because he was so, I don't know what the right word is. He was just so detached from it all that it just,
yeah, he feels pretty broken throughout this right. show. So you don't see much of an emotional turn from him. And you know, his wife has died.
Right.
So for him being stuck in this sort of depression phase of, you know, of the, you know, stages of grief, there's no question that, you know, or maybe even bargaining a little bit with him trying to make his daughters feel better and jumping into this new relationship. He's trying to find a way to make what he's experienced okay, and is clearly still struggling with it. I think that's why we see him really struggle to like have a genuine emotional moment.
Right. Yeah. He's definitely, I mean, when I was saying that's very British yeah. old guy, I mean, and he's the actor is really Scottish. You could hear that in his, in his voice. It's very much, you know, it's that you got to not show any emotion. And, you know, he was always just very, well, you know, you're my daughters. And that was the extent of, you know, what he was trying to say was, I love you girls so much. And you're a part of my life, but it was just like, you're my daughters. And that was it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm an old guy, you know, I'm 50 years old, and I try so hard to be in touch with my emotions, especially with my kids.
Yeah.
And it was really frustrating for me to watch him be that way with his kids. So I felt sympathy for him, I still felt anger at him about it.
Yeah, for sure. Because you see what the girls are going through, and you just sort of wish that there was some extra support, some extra guidance, some extra presence that they obviously needed,
right?
As they went through this grieving process that they're still going through. And yeah, but that's, I think sometimes, and maybe we can, as we sort of wrap up today's episode, sure. we'll talk a little bit about our own sort of experiences in light of this show. You know, I think one of the reasons the grieving is so hard is that frequently the people that we lean on for support are also experiencing this grieving process. You know, I know for me, when I think back to my grandma, my Nana passing away, this is a couple years ago now, and the person or the people that you would go to talk about feeling sad or feeling upset or frustrated or whatever the emotion is like, well, I would talk to my mom, or I would talk to my wife, or I would talk to my siblings. And it's like, well, I mean, they're all going through this too. I don't want to pile stuff right. on them. I think there's this experience of, well, we'll all just kind of put a brave face on and just try to get through this as best we can.
Right.
And this is not a criticism of anyone in my family. I think we did, frankly, an incredible job in my Nana was very sick, and we helped her kind of get through that process as best we could together. And then we were certainly there for each other in the aftermath of all that. But I just think that this is a common experience for people, which is, how do we talk about this in a way that's not going to make us feel bad ourselves or feel bad for the other people who we know are also going through this experience?
Yeah, it's good if you, I mean, even if you're afraid of burdening them, I think it's at least good if you can commiserate, you know,
yeah,
and,
sure,
share,
sure.
and share yeah. and share that. I mean, I think that's kind of a part of the purpose of family and friends, is you can share a burden together.
Yes, absolutely.
So
yeah.
I think that's really what it comes down to. And, you know, whether it's finding your happiness, you know, and therapy, if that's what it requires, then
sure.
definitely do that. I mean, mm-hmm. seek that out. I mean, it, you know, and you don't have to be going through a crisis to do that. It's good. It's good to, you know, to keep to, it's maintenance, some self-maintenance is
yes.
always good.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, yeah, it's funny you say that. I've been doing a little experiment on my personal Twitter this month, just sort of reframing mental health questions. If you want to check it out, you can follow me at Engelsry, E-N-G-E-L-S-R-Y. And one of the questions I posed was, you know, we have very like clear markers for when like, oh, I should go see a doctor. It's like, well, fever is over 100 or sore throat for a couple days or, you know, sore muscles or bones or bad bruises or things or upset stomach or nausea for a couple days. Oh, you know what? I should probably go get checked out by a doctor. Mm. Like those are clear, identifiable things that if we're experiencing the symptom, we should go get checked out. And there's not the same clear markers for mental health. And I think this is one of the reasons why people delay in months and in some cases years before getting help, because it's like, ah, I mean, this is probably normal, right? This, you know, everybody gets a little down sometimes. But the reality is that sometimes, especially in these big life stage transition things, that just get an evaluation, just get a checkup, sure, yeah. Just like you would with a doctor.
Right.
You know, and the examples that I gave in my Twitter question were like, if you lose your job, if you lose a relationship, if you move, if you lose a close friend or family member or loved one, it needs to be normal. Okay, you know what? I think I'm doing okay, but I'm just going to go, you know, my local mental health clinic. I'm just going to get an evaluation. Just check on how I'm coping or check on what my emotions are. And maybe if I start talking about this stuff, like maybe I'll realize I'm more sad than I thought. Mm. And then maybe I could benefit from a couple sessions. I just think that that's, if we started looking at these sort of big life events that everyone experiences as opportunities to get a checkup, I think that can prevent a lot of, whether it be unhealthy coping skills or impulsive behaviors, from setting in and becoming more normal like Fleabag does.
Very much so. I mean, especially, you know, you get guys my age, you know, especially guys that are my age.
Yeah.
That's like, yeah. You know, it's like, oh, that's sissy stuff, you know? No, mental and physical play a part of each other, and your brain is physical, actually. So you need to take care of it. And it's important to talk about these things and normalize them. And I just, you know, I can't stress enough to, especially women will take care of themselves. They'll talk to people. I mean, even if it's not a therapist, they will try to talk to somebody, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. So yeah, guys, you know, even if you don't want to, if you have a friend you can trust, you know, find a friend you can trust, you know, you know,
yeah.
But at least, you know, get help. I mean, even if you don't need help right now, talk to somebody. It's good to let that out, you know, and talk, you know, I mean, it's
yeah.
Feelings are not a bad
thing. I couldn't have said it better myself. And I think that's a good lesson for Fleabag and maybe a good lesson for us to wrap up our episode today, Dean. So, before we do that, why don't you share with the listeners a little bit about Podskewer or any other projects that you're working on, so the listeners have a good sense of
where else they can find you. I wanted to find out your ranking system. What were you going to do for your ranking on this?
Oh my goodness. You know, I'm so out of I'm so out of practice. Okay. So yes.
I'm trying to keep you on top.
Man, Mike's going to be mad. Okay. So for Fleabag, yeah, so let's do our rankings. So I'm going to do out of 5 hamsters. Guinea pigs, damn it. I'm gonna do out of 5 guinea pigs.
I was gonna do guinea pigs.
Hamster, guinea pig, gerbils. It's hard to resist because it's Hillary the guinea pig, and it's
right.
I never had a guinea pig going up, but if I did, I would have wanted one like Hillary. So I give this a 5. I mean, a lot of this stuff is extreme, but all of it for me felt clearly within the realm of reality. At no point did I feel like if this was exaggerated or unrealistic in terms of and it's an intense grief and mental health response, but I don't think it's an unrealistic one. And, you know, the experiences that Fleabag has in therapy and even on the mindfulness retreat to certain extents are all very real. So it doesn't mean that they're always perfect. But I think they're real, and I think that's my job, is to sort of rank on the scale of, you know, how accurate this is. So I get 5 out of 5 guinea pigs to Fleabag.
All right. Well, in that case, since you took the guinea pigs, I'm ranking on how well I liked it. I'm going to give it 5 wall penises from this exhibition. From something that came up from a 10-minute idea to come into this show. It's brilliant. I mean, it's heartfelt. It's hilarious. It'll make you cry. I mean, it runs the gamut of emotions. I mean, but it's so good. And I mean, I can't imagine somebody watching it and not liking it. I mean, it's really well done. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge has done an amazing job building this out. And actually, I think she's got a couple of her sisters working with her on this, on doing music and art for the show. So bravo.
Yeah. Kudos to all of them. It's a fantastic show. Yeah. Can't wait for season 3.
Oh yeah. So can't wait now. Give it to me.
Okay.
So yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah. For me, so you can hear me, blab a lot, with my buddy Don on Podskure. And if you just look at Podskure podcast, you'll find us out on all the places, the Apples, the Spotify, et cetera. And then, what we do on there is we try to find, other independent podcasters and see what makes them do what they do. It's not really a review show. It's really kind of getting to know everybody, because that's really what it's about. We like this community of independent podcasters. We think it's important to keep the group alive, and not everybody is a Joe Rogan or a Conan O'Brien or whoever, that's, you know, some celebrity that comes in and automatically gets the number one spot. So, and then my other one is a podcast called How Are You Now, which is a podcast about the Canadian TV series Letterkenny, which you can find on Hulu, and you can find us on all the places as well. And it's been a lot of fun doing How Are You Now, and it was a little podcast that we thought was just going to be our friends listening to it, because it was just a tiny little show out of Canada, and then it has just exploded. And so we're really excited about how things are going with that.
Fantastic. And that's something that I have committed, and I'm committing on our podcast now to make sure to hold myself accountable, that I will be coming on How Are You Now some point in the near future, I hope.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
How's that for commitment?
I'll take that. I'm writing it down as well. And you can't delete that MP3 file.
There you go. All right. Well, yes. Fantastic talking to you, Dean. Thank you so much for coming on today's episode, and more in the future, I'm sure.
Oh, many, many more until Mike's ready to come back, and we will, we'll hold down the fort with you.
Much appreciated. All right. So to wrap up today, I want to say thank you again to Dean. We also must thank Kevin MacLeod and his music, which he graciously lets us use. You can find Kevin MacLeod's music on incompetech.com. So thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Dean. And everyone, please stay tuned for my closing thoughts. And with that, thanks, everybody. And now for some closing thoughts on the BBC show Fleabag. Grief is something that we all have to deal with, but it's not something that we all deal with in the same way. So it's incredibly important that we not judge ourselves for the ways that we experience and cope with grief. It's okay to cry out loud. It's okay to cry quietly in private. It's okay to not cry at all. However you deal with grief, though, it must be dealt with. It must be appropriately acknowledged, otherwise it will never resolve. We see Fleabag engage in impulsive and sometimes even dangerous behaviors to perhaps distract herself from these feelings, but that does not make these feelings go away. And only until she starts engaging in healthier behaviors and healthier relationships do we start to see some positive improvement. So, and we emphasize this in the episode, obviously, but if you lose someone, especially someone close to you, like Fleabag does, please seek out therapy. At least get an evaluation. It can only help. You know, and if not therapy, there are excellent support groups available. There are online forums. Get help. Find a place where you're comfortable sharing your feelings, and let those feelings exist in the real world. We promise that they won't be a prison that you will get trapped in with them, but that they will flow naturally the way they are supposed to. Thank you, as always, to my co-host, Mike Graham. Take care of yourself. Come back soon. Thank you, Dean, for filling in with us today. You can find Pop Psych 101 on all listening platforms. If you like the show and you want to help us spread the word, please give us a review on iTunes. And with that, thank you, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.